This is a Decentered podcast from Rob Watson. Conversations about community media. Look out for Decentered Media on Twitter and on iTunes, or go to decentered.co.uk. Hello, it's Tuesday the 25th of February, and this is a Decentered Media podcast with Rob Watson and John Costa. And this is the 60th podcast that we've done, or are doing. And so we thought we'd have a kind of a reflection time. So it's just us today. Did you think we'd get to 60?
Well, Robert, I never...
I was going to sing happy birthday, then you spot it. Not really. I mean, it's really interesting. We've always approached this as very much like therapy in motion. And so when it started on a sort of weekly basis and then kind of developed from there, I suppose the expectation was, well, you know, it'd be great when we've done 10. And obviously you've already done quite a lot of recordings anyway, and I've supported some of those. So, you know, I should imagine this is probably somewhere near 100 or 120 if we're to include everything. But the ones that you've actually numbered, as you said, and put up as Decentered Media, this is actually number 60. So to reflect back on it and be brutally honest with you, no, because the expectation was always 1 week at a time, and eventually we'd run out of people to talk to, or we'd get bored of talking to each other. I don't think we've ever had an on-air fight, have we?
No, not yet. No, I'm sure we'll do that before 100, yeah, and we'll reflect on that afterwards. 120, just to keep it kind of balanced. So that first one was, I had to look and kind of find out who was involved in the first one, and it was me and you with Dave Needham.
And that was in the VJ Patel building, wasn't it?
On the DMU campus, yeah. So that kind of took me back, really, in terms of we didn't have any expectations at the time other than to kind of loosely talk about things to do with community media.
And I think it was always making it relevant to what someone was doing. I seem to remember that wasn't the first one that we'd done with Dave. So he was used to, he'd done a couple by then as well. And it was more about coming and update us what you were doing. I think he was doing a lot of stuff with mountain trike, a lot of his events and stuff that he was doing around endurance in order to raise the profile of sort of his motor neuron disease, and also fundraising and stuff. So I think by starting that way, it was always, we were able to link community media through it or find that thread, whereas we always tried to get someone to come in and talk about something about, you know, what they were doing, an event or, you know, their job role, or we'd normally come across them through networking or through teaching or through doing something like that. So
I mean, looking back, just flicking through them on my phone, the first couple with the, you know, the first stage of doing this really was around me going out talking to people sometimes and kind of taking the Zoom recorder and just sitting and having a chat with somebody, but in a more, I suppose, more like an interview sense. And so we spoke to Sam and Des at Leicester Community Radio. We spoke to Dimple at Radio 2 Funky, VJ at Eva FM. And then I went up to Liverpool and spoke to Steve Farragher at Liverpool Community Radio.
And they were all early ones, weren't they?
Yeah, they were early ones, trying to, you know, travelling about really, and go kind of being at different places. And we've settled into a pattern since, really, of kind of sitting, you know, because you've now got the Dot Media Centre, so it's been a base where we've been able to invite people, give them a cup of tea.
As you say, it's somewhere settled. I think that's what it is. It's an address. It's somewhere settled. You know, no one, you know, I'm in charge. I'm not going to hassle us to get out. I'm happy for us to talk. I suppose, if anything, the self-imposed 1 hour or 60-minute limit makes us be quite focused and help educate the guests before we say to them as well, this is what we'd like the format to be. So once you've made people comfortable with tea and the biscuits that you bring every week, it just means that there's that regularity there. But then you're able to go out and do your visits still, or go and do a couple of the events that you've done recently as well, up in Liverpool and here in Leicester as well. And also Skype, you know, making good use of things like Skype as well. So that's what makes me think, you know, we're at 60 and here we are reflecting. Before we realise it, we'll definitely be at 100, and before we know it, it'll be at 200. And I think if you dip back into your archive, then, you know, very much 250 and 300, and you're suddenly, well, what makes you an influencer? If we're gonna look at that kind of stuff, interesting.
It was a conversation I had the other day about who was it with? My mind's gone blank.
You've been Skyping too many people.
I know. I've spoken to too many people in the last few days. It confuses me. But it was, you know, kind of, I don't put any effort into it. And actually, the more effort you do put into it, the harder it becomes. Whereas if you kind of just find a pattern and a routine, which is nice and easy, so no editing as much as you can. You know, what, I think there's probably in the whole 60, I've edited, as in cut things out, about two or three times.
I apologise about what I said during this. No, yeah. I'm assuming it wasn't me.
Well, I've got them there, you know, so I could always release them at some point. So
got the evidence.
Yeah, but then you know, all I do is put a little bit of processing on it just to balance the levels out a little bit, and then mix it in with the title tune, and then turn it into a single file. So the whole thing now I can kind of get done almost within half an hour and posted up online. And you have, it was something I learned from you actually, which was when you would tell us that story about how you learned to do YouTube videos.
So it was always about, I remember getting a very Nokia N95. It was fantastic. It was known as the citizen journalist phone. I used to walk with a bounce in my step then, because I had got this phone, and it was like, this is so heavy. No, I didn't walk with a limp. I walked with a bounce because I was being a little bit cocky. And what it was, it just allowed you to, you know, tweet and do all those kind of things now, all of which we kind of take for granted. But back then, sort of 2009, 2010, iPad coming on stream times was still quite new. And I think that's why Citizen's Eye came along, was this breath of fresh air and caught a few people on the hop, really, because it wasn't traditional media. And so I always remember Andy Williams sort of enjoying the fact that as a citizen journalist or community reporter, he was taking photographs of the Mercury photographer, taking photographs, that kind of layers of the onion, if you like. We weren't trying to be the mainstream. We were there capturing things that other people didn't. And so when I registered for the YouTube channel in 2009, it was more a case of, well, I can either teach myself to edit these things, download it, you know, laptop, that kind of stuff. And because we were operating out the library, it was very much, well, if I don't get it in one take, then I'm screwed, really, because I'm not going to be able to edit it. So it got to the point where I got quite good at using straps of rucksacks, or, you know, the sleeve of my coat, or, you know, leaning against things, lampposts and stuff. Even a monopod that I had for quite a while, a leg thing, type extendable thing, like a walking stick, to lean on, and just got used to being able to introduce something, you know, John Costa from Citizen's Eye, God, if I've heard that a million times, and be able to capture it. And I always used to say to people, when I'm about to interview them, I used to mess up and make them laugh, and I wasn't filming at all, just to try and get them to think about the fact that, you know, to be relaxed, because again, for most people, it was very new to be have just like a smartphone or anything sort of poked in your face, let alone a camera. And so I just got used to being able to do it in one take, making sure that I already thought about what I was going to film, how we were going to film it. I mean, I think some of the best stuff that I've done has been at events where I've kind of pre-planned three or four stops that I'm going to have, and I walk from one to the other, and people, how do you manage to do that? I said, well, necessity. And I think that, I remember once at, it was Comedy in the Dark, we were filming something, and I was doing an interview at the Belmont Hotel in the basement, and it was comedy, it was completely in the dark, and it was with Jeff Rowe, the head of the comedy festival, and he had a coughing fit. I mean, literally a full-on, like, emptying his lungs, bent him in half, coughing fit in the dark. And then when he came back up again, I said, should we carry on? And he's like, you're going to edit that out? I said, I can't. So we've had, like, fire engines. I mean, with Nancy and Vicky, I remember sitting outside the Loseby Lane Age Concern shop when the fire engine went past. And we just in hysterics of laughter. And I think a lot of people used to watch it because it was real. You know, it wasn't trying to be, you know, BBC East Midlands or ITV Central, you know, it wasn't full of heavy editing and sort of, you know, here we are, blah, 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 in the depths of stuff, you know. At the same time, we weren't trying to put machine gun noises at it and pretend we were in any kind of conflict zone when we were filming in the market. It was just very real. And I remember the mayor at the time, the Lord Mayor, Manjula Sood, I think the 19th, 21st Lancers had had Freedom of the City, so it's kind of tank thing came through and loads of soldiers, and it was all formed up in Town Hall Square, and there was lots of people running up and down with the media and photographing, and I just stood there, literally, I think I've got two 10-minute videos, you know, completely unplayable now on YouTube because people just wouldn't watch them. But I remember her saying to me a couple of years later that we were laughing about different events that I'd captured when she was the Lord Mayor. And she said, I always remember getting back and just thinking to myself, I don't remember any of it. She said, when you're in the event, you don't remember. She said, I remember there was loads of people there walking up and down in the crowd. She said, and I found your two films. She said, I watched it. She said, and my memory now of that event are your two 10-minute films of me inspecting the troops. And I think that captured that for a lot of people, which was, it was more about if you weren't here, that's what it was about, and if you were there, it was a way of remembering. And I think we got to, I think it's 1200 over 1200 films now on YouTube, which at some point I need to archive as part of the 7 years of the Citizen's Eye and a museum, a community media, like a virtual museum. But I think it was always driven by that, and I think that's what I like about this podcast. And it very much goes back to, you paid me a very nice compliment earlier, and I will return it to you early on in the podcast, get it in early. I always remember when you first got me teaching at the university, you said about, you know, if something's worth doing, it's worth doing badly. And of course a lot of people misinterpret that, but what it actually means is, you know, this is a safe space to try and fail, because YouTube is very much about, you know, 5 minutes of doing this, suddenly you're an expert or an influencer. And it was very much around, you know, when you've got all the gear out, as you have many times, and laid it all out on the table, is incredibly impressive. And, you know, we've been to Cambodia a couple of times, and it came out the backpack, and we had towels from the back of the tuk-tuk, which was quite funny. We've done one round a swimming pool. Here we are now using a Zoom and two mics, sitting in the archive and library here at the museum. And so it can expand and contract to be realistic. And I remember you having a big trolley and a big case with loads of stuff in it, and you've turned up with your backpack today, and the backpack that you bring, you know, even when there's four or five mics, it's that flexibility to be able to add to and operate on a very basic basis. And I think that's really what I like about this podcast, and why it's such an easy vision to buy into, because it's really demonstrating to people that if you're listening to this, it's actually what it's actually saying to you subliminally is you can actually do one yourself, and it's encouraging you positively not only to come on and be a guest, but actually, you know, take the plunge yourself and get into it. And I think podcasting now is at that point where not only is there people making money and stuff like that, which makes it easier because advertising seems to be getting into it, and we'll come on to that later on again maybe, with the role of podcasting and how it's changing, but also the fact that I think it's a little bit like blogging used to be, or a little bit like using your smartphone. People are waiting for permission to try their own podcast, and once they've done it once, they realize just how easy it is to do it. And of course the challenge then is getting the right guests and putting yourself out and people listening to you because you're an influencer, and you're encouraging people to get involved in it. So not, you know, if you want to make one about selling products, or, you know, reviewing food or reviewing DVDs and that kind of, great, fantastic. But what you probably find is there's a lot of community radio programs, shows and stations that will be quite happy to take that content from you as well, because you're not playing the music. You're not coming here because you want to be a DJ. You're coming here from the point of view of actually you're kind of a bit of an issue expert and quite knowledgeable.
One of the things that I don't watch many YouTubers. So everything I've learned about doing vlogs, which I've started to do again more recently, is quite how would I describe it? Basic. That's the best word.
On the go.
Yeah.
On the hoof.
I watch some, and there's so much editing goes into them, and so much thought about, you know, the background and the lighting and the camera and everything. And I think, how have people, you know, and you hear stories about people who are committed to making an income from being a YouTuber, and they spend, you know, their entire week churning out product all the time and inventing things, and they're just exhausted from it. Although they, you know, the myth is that they make lots of money out of it as well. And I kind of wonder, you know, it's why are we seeing? I mean, am I looking in the wrong places? Maybe they don't come up in my feeds, and I don't get the recommendations to see them. And the network connections, maybe, you know, Facebook might be a better place for seeing these things. But, you know, that kind of, we've for years, you know, this has been a long process of supporting and advocating and helping people to become community reporters and to use what they've got to hand and to use it in whichever way is possible. But it hasn't, I don't see it around us. I don't see, we're still dominated by large mainstream media organisations, or these, you know, Googleized YouTube slick operations, and there isn't that space. But are people doing the stuff in the middle ground, which is that DIY, you know, not worrying about the quality, just putting things out there and fairly randomly. I don't see, you know, certainly in Leicester, I don't see much of that going on. And I'm just wondering if, you know, is it like a forlorn hope that this kind of thing would emerge spontaneously, or do we need to get back to doing some of the things that you started doing with Citizen's Eye, and, you know, kind of priming people for this again? And as we need to find a better phrase than giving people permission, but, you know, supporting people to do it and encouraging people to do it, and to kind of, yeah, go and stand at the side of the marketplace with your phone and explain to people what's going on. You know, go and stand on your neighbourhood, the corner of your road, and talk about the parking. Go and stand by the bins that are scattered along the street because people don't take them in, or whatever it is, you know, whatever those issues are. That doesn't seem to have taken place.
Yeah, and I think it's very much that, you know, when we started Citizen's Eye in 2008, you know, it was unheard of. You know, no one knew anything about it, really. There was people doing it and doing it very well that we used to look at and admire as well, which was always made it slightly embarrassing about getting the first beacon hub of citizen journalism and stuff, because there were many other people that I could name that should have got that award. And I remember Adam Perry from the Media Trust saying, yeah, but when I spoke to all of those people, they were always saying none of them could engage volunteers the way that you did. So I suppose that point of view, I was genuinely committed to people being able to have a voice, not those people being on Citizen's Eye. It was about them being empowered to do it. And that's also one of the reasons why I shut it after 7 years in 2014, because everybody was able to own and shape their own narrative and create their own content through things like Facebook and Twitter. And so really the need for what Citizen's Eye was about, we had a few different changes, that the Mercury getting smaller, the BBC taking more stuff from London, the city mayor coming in 2010, 2011 to the city council, meant that no one was prepared to comment because it all came through the channel of the city mayor. So we were getting the same press releases as the Mercury and the Radio Leicester, and I didn't want to compete with them because we were in a different space. We weren't about that at all. We were about issues, bringing people together from lots of different areas and postcodes and genders and, you know, geographic and demographic groups and stuff. We weren't hyperlocal. We weren't only interested in one postcode. So that's very different. And I think what we also found was that the more you spoke to people, the more they were able to create that little community. So they didn't need to be as open and inclusive, because we were dealing with lots of local issues and trying to put them into context globally as well. Imagine how impressive Citizen's Eye would have been if the Sustainable Development Goals would have been around, but that's another podcast maybe. But the fact that what happened was that people were influencers in their own way around specific issues. And I think what happens now is people are able to do that and get a sizable following. I mean, I've got 21,000 plus followers now on Flipboard. So, you know, am I an influencer? I often say to the students, you know, how many people is it? If you're trying to sell something, is it how many people sell or actually buy from you? And if you're trying to influence people, how many people are still joining now? So I'd probably add 3, 4 to 10 people a day. So I'll wake up in the morning, I've been added overnight, which is obviously you know, sort of Southeast Asia, that kind of way. And then later on in the day I'll find a few people from America, and you add to it and you think, well, that keeps you going. But the only thing I'm getting out of it is the fact that I know when I put the information up there, someone's looking at it, using it and doing something with it. And so I think for me that's what motivates me to keep going. And when I first set up Flipboard quite a few years ago now, you could never find anything on audio at all. And then obviously Serial came along and dominated everything, the podcast, and everyone got involved in it. And now I struggle to find anything that relates to global issues and stuff, because it's dominated by big Oscar Netflix series, Amazon series around documentaries, you know, the Obamas putting their money into it and stuff. And you know, still photography, is photography dead? You know, mobile phone photography, it's not as good as photojournalism, but it's dominated, absolutely dominated, wall to wall by the commercialization of being able to make money from podcasts. So in fact, in that short period of time, it's gone completely the other way.
Yeah, there was that period, wasn't there? Kind of the Henry Jenkins participative turn stuff in the mid-noughties, 2006, I think it was, where you had this kind of, you know, the promise of the internet and the World Wide Web and the birth of social media as being something which would encourage participation. But in many ways, it's kind of been stitched up and monetized and reduced to commodities, because that's the capitalist process, that's what supports it. It's always going to do that until the system is changed in some way. But the kind of couple of things that you mentioned then, which I think are, I wonder, you know, what I worry about, I suppose, is this, the kind of focus has become very much about citizens' journalism. And even the word journalism, I mean, when did we probably have to go back, you know, 20 or 30 years really, to, you know, most people who worked in newspapers wouldn't have considered themselves as journalists. They were reporters. And when did the term journalism become so prevalent? Probably when journalism, you know, news was something that became commodified within universities. Get your qualification to be a journalist. It's got more prestige to be a journalist than to be a reporter. You can be a reporter as an apprentice. For a journalist, you need to have a degree, you know, that kind of thing. So that's changed the nature of our understanding. But then the research that follows that is all framed around, and the studies and the impact studies and the kind of social evaluation of this is framed around the paradigm of citizens' journalism. And I kind of almost, you kind of feel as if you have to go and look at that, you know, look around and see what they're on about. You know, it's like visiting a town that they're your rivals. You know, it's like going from Leicester to Derby. You know, this Derby County, you know, classic rivals for Leicester City, but you've never been to Derby, and then one day you suddenly go and you go and have a look around. Well, citizens' journalism, you know, let's go and look around what they're doing and saying. And actually, you kind of get there and you go, oh, it's just another boring shopping centre, and half the shops are shut. And there's nothing, there's not really that great kind of, so we've got just as much as they've got. So if we want to call them community reporters and they want to call them citizens' journalists, let's kind of split the difference, you know, in some way. But stop using if the terminology matters in that way. And then the other one that you mentioned was that kind of sense of influencers. So we've moved from a situation where people are kind of activists to being influencers, and that's seen a change. And I wonder how much of this is tied in with the impact of austerity, and the, you know, the very real effects of an austerity agenda, as that have seen, you know, the charities, to be fair to local authorities and charities, had to change what they're doing, and they've had to adopt much more narrow and blunter working practices, business practices, to consolidate what they do and to stay safely within the boundaries of what they can offer. So they're fixed along the tram lines, if you like, and they stick to that. But what they're not doing is exploring anywhere else and finding out what else goes on.
Well, I'll answer that in reverse order. I think when we came to an end with Citizens Eye in 2014, and we did for a year or so, 16 months, the Community Media Training School at BBC Radio Leicester, they let us host that in the College of Journalism, the Kojo Room, which we were very shocked about at the time. But I think that's as much about the BBC was embracing the whole concept around user-generated content. Okay, so let's deal with the austerity thing first. I think what happened with the third sector because of austerity is the jobs that went first were the ones that you could outsource, like HR and payroll, and then jobs that were seen as being maybe a little bit frivolous, because when you're trying to survive, the last thing you have time to do is celebrate and or tell people about what you're doing and communicating that. So suddenly the marketing and PR person was seen as a luxury, the event manager was seen as a luxury, and then some long-suffering member of staff or volunteer was given the role of organising this year's fundraising event or carnival. Oh my God, you know, my turn again, and what did I do wrong? I tried to mess it up last time, I didn't want to do it again, a bit like making a cup of tea. Don't make me a good one, you'll be making tea forever. So you've got that situation where, with all that going, what we tried to do with the training school was get people to understand that there's much more informal ways that you could communicate what you were doing with your service users, say through Facebook, a Facebook page, but also through your supporters and potential funders through Twitter, rather than worrying about sort of, you know, press releases and all these kind of things, sending it into the Mercury and not getting in, or changing the way that you wrote a press release to the point where it was easy for the local media to order to cut and paste it and put it straight in, as became the case in many situations. So there was no reporting going on, it was more cutting and pasting and putting on websites and into the newspaper. So there was that. And what you had then was, at the same time why that was happening, you had the mainstream media suddenly realizing that they were losing a lot of revenue to, you know, potentially websites and local magazines, and all of which wasn't really true. So what they did, I think, again, one of those classic Project Fear, is they decided to call it citizen journalism and or user-generated content as a way of taking the heat out of it by turning around and saying, well, actually, as professionals, we've got a lot that we can teach you. So if you want to become a citizen's journalist, then there's still ways that you know, you need to be compliant and you should be thinking of this. So we never saw ourselves as citizen's journalists ever. Full stop, period. We were community reporters. It was our community, and we were able to comment on that or capture what was going on. We were reporting on what we were seeing. Three times people came to me with some really big stories. One was about an absolute appalling case in the NHS, and the other two that I won't mention. Both times I gave them a named person to go off and speak to at the Leicester Mercury, and just said, we are just not capable of breaking that story. That's not what we're about. You know, we're not whistleblowers, we're not trying to catch anyone out. We kind of knew what we were good at, because we also looked at what we weren't and what we weren't trying to do. And I think by being realistic, that's really why it kind of bumped along the bottom, and after 7 years it came to a natural end. I think if I was trying to set out at the time to have created something that was, you know, franchisable, or, you know, almost like that Bristol Cable is now, is a fantastic example of independent, you know, local journalism done well, and there are many other examples as well. I think I'd have approached it very differently, but that was never what we were trying to do. And it's interesting when people say, oh, Citizens Eye did this, or you should bring it back, and we never did that. They go, oh, but you did that, we never did that either. You know, so it's always become like a myth and a legend because it was finished 6 years ago, you know, what it was able to do, which is wonderful. It was a lovely pat on the back for me, and I get quite emotional about it sometimes, thinking back when I look at the photos, 15,000 photos on Flickr, 1,200 on films on YouTube. I think I found 180-odd podcasts the other day on Audio Boom, where we captured audio files. I mean, we never even called them podcasts back then. You look back at that and you think, yeah, we did some good stuff. We set people off in some interesting journeys, both young and old, of all different backgrounds, to believe that they had the ability to do that. But it was never about getting someone trained to give them access to the BBC or stuff like that. We were just very realistic in what we were trying to do. And you found that everybody's definition of what Citizens Eye was and what they were trying to get out of it was down to them. You know, Tina's big on that. You know, she said, John, every single person had their own experience of Citizens Eye. And if you were able to interview them or get them to write down one sentence about what Citizens Eye was, she said you'd have, you know, thousands of different explanations about it. And I think with that, you've got what social media is and how social media is allowed to be used by individuals to either about themselves, so it's that kind of social side. If they want to make it about an issue they're interested in, there's the community media element. And if they want to capture it, keep it, archive it, or, you know, put it out for peer review, then you've got that documentary media element, which we do here. That's where, for me, the definitions have come about from. So there's people that are very active and proactive that you'll never come across because they are very focused or niche, for want of a better term, on their particular issue. And that's why suddenly being on social media, even though for all, you know, I hear a lot of people going, I don't use Twitter, you know, I've abandoned Facebook and all that sort of stuff. Well, what you're actually doing is I understand where you're coming from with that, you know, but at the same time, you're also cutting off a source of information for yourself, because people that invariably think that also think that about the mainstream media. And, well, ultimately, where are you getting your information on? Because as far as I can see, you're shutting every curtain in the house and you're sitting in darkness wondering why the world's falling apart. Whereas, in fact, when you open a few blinds and open the window, you suddenly realise there's a lot of good stuff going on in the world.
This is the difference between you and I.
We're getting a bit deep now, aren't
we? No, I think this is really, really interesting. Some of the stuff I've been listening to recently put this into a kind of context. So, and we've talked about this, the difference, you know, introversion and extroversion. And you're an extrovert, you're the campaigning type.
I'm very quiet and shy, Rob.
You are, and you're unbecoming. And then, actually, there is an argument to be had about doing that thing of sitting at home, closing the curtains, because there is too much information out there. And that can give you... And actually, what you fail to do in that moment is draw on your inner voice or inner experience that tells you where your values are, what your emotions are, that kind of thing. And the flip side is the expectation that you're always plugged in, that you're always a scanning for information, that you're always scanning for opportunities. And what we don't do then is to figure out what are the priorities and what's important to us, because we're constantly then seeking either the approval of other people or the ratings of other people. It's extreme. And I wonder, you know, approaching it now, and we're going to be doing some training for some young people about employability skills in the coming weeks and months. You know, that might, you know, when I've established these things in the past, I've very much done it on the basis, yeah, you've got to be scanning things, you've got to know where everything is, you've got to network, you've got to be constantly on top of information. Actually, I think my starting point now is now, because it's now so well, it's so available, so, you know, it's always on, it's always there, is actually, no, you need to push that aside, because to work out what a story is and to work out what the principles of that are underpinning a story, and to come back to something that you said earlier, which was about, you know, kind of, do you print the... There's a David Byrne, lead singer of Talking Heads, said, you know, between the facts and the myth, print the myth. And there is a sense that... Because printing the myth is where we find out what the story is actually about. The facts only tell us what occurred, what happened. They don't tell us what the story was. And we need to withdraw sometimes, not to a cave, you know, but we need to withdraw from everything that's going on because we don't have enough time to reflect. So that kind of balance, and I think the podcast is a really good way for us to do that. And maybe that's been the, you know, has shaped unconsciously the kind of, you know, the running around to try and interview people, or sitting at home and doing it over the internet now, or sitting in the Dot Media Centre once a week and inviting people in, because there's a different reflection model going on, rather than, if you like, an external engagement thing going on.
I think, yeah, definitely, I agree with you, and I think you're very good at, like, quoting people and all that. I'm terrible with those kind of names.
Rubbish
and quotes and stuff.
Awful.
Well, you make it look good. You make it sound good.
The same one about, yeah, the same quote 16 times a day. Believe me,
John Costa, editor of Citizens, I said, get him in, let him say it himself. I think it's there's a quote, and it says something about, like, you know, a vain person tries to do everything. You know, sort of, I don't know, a marginally clever person tries to pick do the things that are important, and I think what it's about is also just valuing your time, you know, and you know, don't matter how rich or poor you are, or whoever you are, you've only got 24 hours in a day, and it's how you fill those. And so, I mean, the map over your shoulder there, you know, the parallel lives areas, Latin America, West Africa, East Africa, South Asia, and Southeast Asia. People say, you know, there's two ways of looking at that, yeah? There's the reason I capture those 74 countries in those areas and try and do things with them is the fact that, you know, that's part of the global south. They've been on the receiving end of colonialism, an empire, and exploitation of their resources. And so any documentation or a documentarian, film, photography, audio, and new media they create is from someone who can tell you what the impact is, the impact on them, and how they're fighting back against climate change and all that kind of stuff without the resources that we have more in the sort of the developed north, if you like. The other way of coming here from the point of view is that if I try to capture documentarians in all 192 countries, I go stark raving bonkers. So it's more a case of I'm interested in that subject, but look at the impact on the United States of everywhere else. So if you have a documentary made by someone that's from the States, it tends to talk about them and what they're doing in other countries. Whereas if you were talking about the impact of the United States on Brazil, and it was made by a Brazilian, it would be very different. What their impact is. Australia impact on Indonesia. You can cover China through its impact on everybody else through Belt and Road. And then obviously Europe, you've got the impact on, you know, from a colonial empire, not just Britain, but quite a lot of European countries like Spain, Portugal and France and stuff, and Germany to an extent, and Italy even. So, you know, you're still able to cover those other countries. You're not excluding them. You're just almost probably on the receiving end of the content from the loser. Not in a militaristic point of view, but the loser as in it's been their resources that have been exploited in order to develop such a Western European focus on the world and the way that we view the world. So I think it's about being very realistic. So I often say to people, don't try and do it all, and be very selective in what you do, because what it does then is there's comfort in being an expert, you know, and that doesn't mean qualification or a course or even work. It just means that you can be an issue expert based on the fact that you're knowledgeable about that. And what you'll find is that when you do meet a proper expert in that, as in a proper expert that's qualified or, you know, it works in it and does stuff, they're absolutely fascinated to find out and talk to you as an issue expert through interest, that sort of enthusiastic amateur, which is how I've always kind of come at it with citizens, community reporting and all the thing we did with Citizens Eye and now with the Dot Media Centre. And I'm an enthusiastic amateur, which is I can tell you what's going on much better than someone who's a journalist writing for The Guardian. Yeah, they'll be able to quote it at a certain level, but if you want to be able to connect with those people today on the front line where the rubber meets the road, where, you know, the palm oil is being done, where the forest is being cut down, that kind of stuff, where people are being exploited, people going down mines, people being trafficked, then I can probably show you, hook you up with and link you with factual information that's about that. But also to put it into context and also to give it some sort of meaning, as in the world that we're in today and the impact. And what surprises you generally is the fact that, and you find this even more if you bother to get on a plane and go and see, is the fact that a lot of what is going on in these so-called, you know, developing or least developed countries is in fact they've got the sense of community that we've lost in what we consider ourselves developed, and we snootily look down our nose at other people. Whereas in fact we're probably de-developing and are very much good sort of turning on each other and sort of, you know, pointing out our differences and stuff, because we've got to the point where we've lost that connection with community. And there's also an element of jealousy about it, where suddenly there's something wrong with them because they look after their older people. There's something wrong with them because they care about the environment as if it's bad. And why would people living in the Brazilian rainforest not want to have Amazon and Netflix and mobile phones and football shirts? And, you know, why do they want to run around like that firing bows and arrows at each other? And I think we need to push back against that through showing the good stuff. You know, I said to someone on a film once, they interviewed me about here, and they said, what do you want people to do? I said, fall back in love with the world. You know, we've allowed the mainstream media to own the narrative that the world is falling apart. What that also allows you to do is it makes you disconnect and disengage from politics, from watching the media, because you feel as if that is only bad news. And of course, you then buy into the whole thing, like, yeah, we need to go to another planet, don't we? Because we've messed this one up. And of course, what you suddenly realise is that with all of these things, they're all human issues that have been made about plastic in the ocean and the impact of climate change. So whether you agree with it or not, at the end of the day, things are melting. You know, and you know, I'm not being funny, ice is not meant to melt. Whether it's in the north or the south, and a big iceberg is a problem floating through the ocean because it affects the temperature. So, you know, as Greta Thunberg said, you know, don't give me an award. All I want you to do is listen to the scientists. And for some reason, the media is in collusion with big money, organised crime, politicians, big business to actually keep you disinterested in what is really going on, interested in stuff that isn't important, so, you know, entertainment, all this kind of nonsense, and social media as a way of making you feel that you are engaged, okay, in the world, when in fact you're not. Now, the classic example of that that I'll give, and I couldn't have given this before this podcast, was last night I went to a meeting, it was about the NHS, best hour and 10 minutes I've sat in for ages, very experienced academic talking about it, was very knowledgeable. some of the usual suspects sitting around tutting about things that they normally do. And what was fascinating was one young person said something, and an older person turned around and said, oh, young people now, and young people don't care about trade unions, and young people don't understand this. And I put my hand up and I said, listen, you know, as a freelance journalist and someone who teaches here part-time, I can tell you I engage students in conversations about all of these issues, and they do care. It's just you don't talk to them about it. And it's never put in context. And when it is put in context, a young person is able, you know, within reason, to logically turn around and say, I can understand the value of a trade union. I can understand, you know, why that's important, why this might be important, why the NHS at the point of sale is important. But what we never do is we've never explained to these young people where it's come from. There's never been any context. So really, from a societal point of view, our education system needs to change so that we start at the point of the reason we have something like the NHS is where it came from. And then you can have an adult conversation about should it be privatised, should it be privatised, should it be kept the way that it is, how much of it has been privatised already, how much of it do we not already own. We don't give people the reason, the tools to be able to find out this information, unless you're saying to someone, well, watch a documentary and educate yourself. And, well, I can watch a documentary on Netflix, but I've got exactly the same questions that I had when I went to the cinema, but it always seems the same people in the cinema get to be the ones who ask the questions afterwards. So if we're not educating young people and giving them the skills to do that at school,
including them in the process,
absolutely,
in a different way,
then suddenly someone's not going to turn around and say, well, yeah, why not pay for it then? You know, I don't understand why it's a problem. I pay for my Netflix, I pay for Amazon, and you're telling me the I need to keep the I should be supporting you to keep the BBC licence fee. Why? I don't understand. Where did the licence fee come from? And of course, our media is very good at pointing out why we're different and where the divisions are and polarising. And that's the thing that I find about fighting back. And this is what I said to these guys last night when I kind of pulled my mobile phone, as I did normally do, out my phone out my pocket and wave it around and say, it's time for you to be weaponized. What you don't understand is the actual power that you have in your pocket here. Just because you don't use Twitter, yeah, don't either have a go at people that do, but don't have a go about something if you don't understand the power that it has, because you don't have any power through politicians anymore, or politics, or voting, because Brexit demonstrated that. The mainstream media does not represent you. It either wants you to believe what it says or it wants to alienate you. So in fact, the one thing that we give a hard time about all the time, and young people being on their mobile phones and social media, really, if we all woke up, is in fact one of the few ways that's truly democratic where we could actually get online and actually start pushing back about that stuff. So I said, well, I'll come along and have a chat at one of your meetings about, oh, that'd be wonderful. And I can't believe I'm the only person in the room that can use Twitter. It's suddenly I just turned around and said, look, I've invented fire. Why don't we sit down and have a look at it? It's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
sorry, mate, I was on a bit of a roll then.
No, that was perfect. It was the, I wonder if, I get really frustrated at that thing of people not having a go. You know, it's like, oh, I can't use this, I can't use that. Well, have you tried? Well,
I did once,
and I've only got, you know, kind of, I've got 3 followers or something like that. And it's kind of, I don't have much patience for people in those circumstances, because I'd kind of rather say, look, does it matter? You know, what are you trying to do? You're trying to be perfect. You're never going to be perfect. And so what you do is you don't do anything. So it's all very well being right, morally certain, but if you're not engaging with people, and that's, you know, kind of, it's infected our politics in many ways. You know, the kind of the you know, we've got this self-confirming opinion on particularly the left that we're absolutely right, therefore everybody else must be absolutely wrong. And there's no kind of dialogue in between where you can kind of shift your perspective and look at things from a different way. And it's kind of the... you know, it's what is it that will motivate people to spontaneously want to do this? So we give it over to technology. There's a tweet I saw earlier from Wired magazine that somebody had retweeted about, Is it Natalie Fenton? No, it wasn't Natalie Fenton. It was somebody else who was talking about we have the technology now for every child to have an individualized learning plan, and that you can track their development and their performance right the way through it. Is this a good thing? It's like, oh my God, I couldn't think of anything worse. What happens to the liberal conscience, the thoughts that you have in your head that are yours, that are unique, that you know, if you are tracked on an individual basis as to what it is that you are thinking about and how you express those thoughts, then that is totalitarianism. You know, clear and simple, you're repressing people's individual conscience. And you can't get much more, you know, kind of dangerous than that. So there's a danger that we just give it over to the technology. So it's become, you know, the reason why community media hasn't prospered is because this thing came along of social media where everybody had the individual ability, if they wished to take it up, to sit and have a relationship with their phone or tablet or whatever, or their watch or whatever it's become now, and to flick through it and to make choices. But they're compartmentalized and individualized, atomized choices. And it's an addictive process, and they're designed to keep us addicted to this thing that's churning around. And yes, in many ways, it can create really positive, encouraging networks and connections with people. But at the same time, it can create a huge sense of anxiety and dislocation and, you know, that kind of sense that you're, you know, the feeling of missing out and all that kind of stuff, which we never used to have. You know, if you go back to the night, I was, you know, kind of, I always say, you know, what, talk to me mum and says, you know, what was life like in the 60s? And she says, I don't know, it was too busy having kids. You know, the swinging 60s was nothing to do with her. You'd have to be in a certain subgroup of a certain cultural subcultural layer within London, within the pop music industry and the film industry. But I heard, again, I heard an interesting, there's a line on an interesting podcast that was talking about what's the one thing that capitalism really can't do. It can do in a way, but it can't really get to us. And it's the commodification of our dreams, because we don't control our dreams, and we don't control those things that emerge from our unconscious. They just pop forward. Yes, we can pay for expensive analysts, and yes, we can sign up for dream interpretation courses, but the dreams we're not in control of. That's why they come from the, that's why they emerge from the unconscious. It's the part of our, you know, kind of, and the argument is that this is not just an individual thing, but this is also a cultural, collective, social thing as well, and we have a kind of social connections, a collective unconscious of these things. So there's something going on which is generating a dislocation and a sense of meaningfulness, but we've got all of these tools at hand in order to be able to fill the gaps. It's just that the patterns of behavior that we're doing and that we're using to try and it's like kind of the answer that you've been given is a cupboard full of pills, and you've got as many pills as you want to take. You know, there's hundreds of them in there. Just choose a different colour. They all have a different effect. And but actually the answer is to get out and go for a walk and get some dogs and take them out across the fields or something like that, or go and, you know, kind of sit and have a cup of tea with people in a cafe, not to resort to the pills. But the social media angle has been told to us as a kind of, you know, a soporific, a drug replacement. And I'm not kind of, and I like the phrase you always, I'm not sure whether you use the phrase then consciously or unconsciously, because it's down to your accent, which is woke. And you said, you know, people need to be more awoke. And it came across as woke. And that causes a lot, you know, the kind of controversy at the moment in terms of political discussion and engagement.
I don't really understand the term, and you know, it's just sometimes I just find these terms are created as a way of keeping us compartmentalised again, and sort of, are you this, are you that? You know, you're from there, you believe in this, oh, you would do that. You know, you're from this group, so therefore you're going to do that. I mean, I was talking to a group of Somalian girls that were sitting, one was in a chair where you're sitting there filming themselves on Saturday, and they're from the Somalian Development Service, and they've got some money from the Heritage Lottery Fund, and they're going around recording They're each other's mums and people from the community, because they call them CCTV. When you're not under your mum's gaze, there's another mum watching you and reporting back on you. So it's quite funny, really. And I'm sure it's the same in all communities. And they're going to archive it with MACE, the Media Archive Central England, which is fantastic. And then filming it on their smartphones. Well, they've all got iPhones. And of course, it's made the archive think about, well, actually, you know, the way we're going to get more archive footage from communities that represent all of us here in Leicester and on the, I think they're across 11 counties now, down to Herefordshire from Lincoln, is to make it easier. So it's not about filmmaking and have you got the money, can you make it on your smartphone, but we've got to make it in a certain way. So we've got an app, $3.99, that we download. You can change the frame rate, the audio capture. It just means it's easier for the archive, which is a British standard rather than American standard because it's an Apple product. And so a little bit of intervention at the beginning means that these guys are going to create something amazing. Why? Because it's whatever they create. Remember that when there's nothing and you've created something, of course it's amazing. You know, you've got to come at it from that point of view. And I was talking to the guys about this project, Parallel Lives, and they were looking around the library and that kind of, I'm not saying any of them kind of look through the eyes of we are a white guy, why are you interested type thing. It's the fact that when you start talking about why you do something and what you're passionate about and this is what you do and this defines what you're about and this is why when you go overseas you learn so much more. It was quite revelatory to them, I think, because suddenly they felt as if they were, because they're sort of Somalian and British and some of them had come from Sweden, from Germany and from Holland and stuff, they're quite well travelled, that suddenly I think they come to places where, you know, I said British values are things that are on the walls in schools. They don't really mean anything to me. You know, I'm a citizen of the world. You know, I'm as much European as I am Scottish. I'm as much, you know, a citizen of the world as I am from London, as a Cockney. We can't buy into these boxes that people want us to go into. You know, you've got to come at it from the point of view. If you want to engage with the world, then you've got to strip away boundaries and borders and these walls that people put up, whether they're physical or, you know, just imaginary. The fact that, you know, why are you interested in that? You're from here. Why would you think that? You're from that stuff. And of course, we're very good at doing it from, you know, if you're from this postcode, this is what's going to happen to you. There's reports about it, you know, we always wrap it up in life expectancy and stuff like that. But now it doesn't matter what postcode you come from. If both your parents are working and they can't afford stuff, then you're down the food bank, period. You know, let's get over ourselves now that our social structures and what is poverty and the north-south divide and these things are all real and it can affect people. But where's the media that's reflecting that? You know, on one article from one good journalist in one newspaper that tends to be more balanced than someone else is going to have no impact. It's only when people turn around and start capturing their own content, sharing their own story so that we can own and shape our own narrative. But finding somewhere to put it, so something like the old community channel, Now Together TV, it's easy when it's a choice on your Sky, Virgin Box, BT, whatever, to be able to find it and get your film on there. But what we need to do is we need to get more people looking at that stuff in order to educate themselves, because people are so busy being busy they forget the fact that what we're doing is every day that goes, yeah, something isn't necessarily improving, it just seems to be collectively getting worse. And of course, once you buy into that project fear of everything's melting and everything's going and we're doomed, and therefore what it does, it just makes you internalize even more and affect your own mental health and well-being. Or it's then easier to convince you that it's someone else's fault, you know, that we need someone to blame.
Those, I mean, what comes to mind is Theresa May's, you know, citizens of nowhere jibe, which is just pernicious when you think about it in the context that it was expressed in. And that we need to, one of the things I kind of thinking forward with the podcasts is to be much more constructive. We're really, you know, I've said this the last couple of times, we're really good about identifying some of the problems and we should keep doing that. But also we need to start to imagine what it's going to be like in the future. So this idea of, you know, the model that you've just said of, you know, reduced focus on boundaries. You know, there was a piece in one of the newspapers yesterday, we're really good at building fences in this country. And actually you go and visit our school, you know, my kind of, you know, 40 years... 35, 40 years kind of since I left school, you've seen shutters on high street shops everywhere, big metal shutters. They're on Narborough Road, they're on in Liverpool on Egbeth Road, they're all over the place, and they've never been taken away. They came at a time of social strife and massive change, and they've become permanent and embedded. And you look at our schools now and they all have these 9-foot high fences, which are very well designed now, and but to keep people in or out or whatever the model is. And we're great at this country of building fences everywhere. And it's kind of symbolic that they, the mindset is one of, you know, the biggest cause of consternation is not climate change, it's that the wind blew my fence over. That was the argument, you know, put forward in this article, that, you know, and that says something about our mindset. It says something about the way that we tackle problems. So it's kind of, you know, what is it that we want to be moving towards? What does this kind of, what's the focus? You know, I like this idea of kind of remaining or becoming a global citizen. Well, what does that mean in, because your feet have got to stay on the ground. And, you know, there are responsibilities that we have at home. You know, if you want to be a global citizen, it means abandoning your family and abandoning, the community that nurtured you, I suppose, if it is a nurturing community. I can understand wanting to escape from communities that aren't nurturing. And maybe that's part of the drive. Maybe sometimes a society needs to not focus on nurturing, but to push people away. You know, there's that kind of teenagers, you know, the commonality now of people staying at home for, you know, until they're 30, and then getting, you know, saving up and getting their own place is an economic reality. But psychologically, that's appalling for a society that children are dependent on their parents for such a long time when you should have your independence at 18. And vice versa, when you get, you know, when you become older, your parents are dependent on you, so you've got no freedom. So the relative terms of what it means to be able to make choices and put them into practice while accepting that there are consequences and you have responsibilities in that is a much more difficult argument than we're prepared to frame through our media. Our media is very, as you said, very simplistic, very kind of, kind of consumer focused, that there's an easy answer to this, that there's an app for it, that somebody will design a system which will take the responsibility away from us, rather than putting it back on us to say, actually, you need to justify and explain, you know, on what basis you're making your decisions. I mean, I kind of have an awful lot of sympathy with people who are caught in the floods at the moment. But if you bought a house that was in a floodplain, I have no sympathy with you. But you're expecting, you know, the government's expected to bail you out in some way. And I find that kind of, you know, that impulse, whether it's right or wrong, justified or not, is kind of like, that's what it brings out in your consternation. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you can moan about the, you know, you can sign up for climate change. The Australians, I think, have proven this. You know, they've been faced with, you know, massive fires and climate damage. But they elected a government of climate deniers. And so you kind of reap what you sow. And that connection between the two.
I always think of that Peter Kay sketch when he's talking to his gran, and she looks out and it's pouring a rain, and she said, they ought to do something about this. He went, they? Who's that? What, the government? As if they're going to do anything about the rain. You know? Yeah. They ought to do something about it. And I think we've... And this is where I'm coming from as a global citizen. Not that I can go and live wherever I want as a digital nomad or anything like that, but more about the fact that we are all connected, okay? And the only way that we're going to start producing our own food locally and being able to become self-sufficient and sustainable and all that sort of stuff, we're by growing our own food in the UK, if you like, or Britain, sort of post-Brexit, is the fact that we need to understand where our food comes from, and also, you know, the impact that it does with petrol and bringing it here and fuel and stuff, but also the fact that the impact that it's going to have if we do choose to go sustainable on those people. So what's happened is you've gone somewhere, all the forests have been cut down in order for someone to grow what you're now buying. Not at a price that's actually affordable for them, because most of it's based on exploitation down the supply chain. But then if we did abandon that and we suddenly got a conscience and we're only going to grow our own food, well, what's going to happen to those people? We seem to disconnect ourselves, that the reason people want to come here, migrate here, whatever. We call them refugee and asylum seekers because it makes us feel better that they don't, you know, the reason they're coming here is to take something we've got, which we don't actually have, is the fact that we've impacted these people to the point where they need to leave. Now, all right, you know, you could look at somewhere like Syria and stuff like that, but we've got to understand the role that our governments have played, people we've elected, many, many governments going right back for years, in the geopolitical scenario where suddenly the media has got us not liking people in North Korea or Iran. Why? Have you ever met an Iranian? Because I tell you, I've met several Iranians and they're really nice people. And I'm sure there's a bad Iranian that you'll be coming across in every 100, just like there is a bad person in every 100 people you meet here in Leicester. Why do we constantly feel as if we are better and superior than people? Because that is a dangerous way to look at the world. Because suddenly it makes you, I don't know,
disconnected.
It's very, I think it's ignorant. It terrifies me when you hear some of the young students as well. And the words come out of their mouth, but that's their parents talking. And I'm like, but what do you think? Well, I read this, but what do you think? And when I heard this, and this is what's so scary for me.
That's interesting. This is where it comes back to that point of sometimes you should close the curtains and lock yourself in a quiet room, because you need to unburden yourself of all those other voices, because that's not giving you space to sort through what your own values are, what chimes with you, in terms of actually they're the voices I respect and they're the voices that make sense. Because if you're just constantly overcrowded and you have no time, but you need to be prepared for that. This is the thing. I mean, it's the stuff I'm reading about at the moment is the kind of I'm reading Hansi Fryneck's second book, which is the follow-up to The Listening Society, which is called The Nordic Model, I think I've got it somewhere, and it is that idea that, you know, society is complex and society has many, the things that we do in our society are interrelated and have many complex consequences, and that we cannot always predict what they are, but we should work on the basis of mitigating as much harm as possible and also facilitating as much movement across any kind of boundaries as possible. But that starts from the mindfulness of the individual to the global perspective of our role, you know, our entire planetary perspective and beyond, universal perspective, if you like, which says what is our place in this order, in this situation, and if we're only teaching things which are compartmentalized or transactional or limited to somebody's self-interest or just their ego, then none of this is sustainable. None of this, and these things are all interconnected, but none of it will happen or make sense if we don't kind of join it up a little bit more.
My final point on it, I'm like banging this drum, yeah, is you get together a kind of mixed bag of people, ages, races, religions, you know, sexualities and all that, people from different places around the world, and you'll get people sitting around watching a program by David Attenborough about ecosystems and animals and interconnectedness and all this sort of stuff, and we'll be sitting there talking to them. You'll ask them conversations and they'll be able to point out every single flaw that in humans, yeah, through talking about it with other animals. You know, look at that community, how they all work, them ants, that's amazing, isn't it? Check that out, you know what I mean? Circle of life, Kuna Matata, you know, Lion King. Being able to, you know, the food chain and that kind of impact on the environment and the impact, that's terrible, blah, blah. Okay, well, you do know everything you've just said there is about the number one animal in the world that causes most of these problems, that's human beings. And they're like, what are you talking about? Yeah, and if that's not come from school, where is it going to come from? Because it ain't going to come from Love Island or Big Brother, and it's not going to come through...
Well, this is where we need the alternative social institutions. This is where we need our community groups. This is where we need our discussion forums.
And independent journalism.
And independent museums and things like that. That's because schools can't be expected to just provide this compartmentalised learning. It has to be a commitment to lifelong challenge and learning. And it has to be constantly reappraising what your role is and what your position is with the world as it changes, as the technology changes. And so that you kind of, you know, you put something back don't just take out of it, I suppose. So last question then, do you think we're going to carry on? What do you think we'll be doing in another 60 podcasts?
In the words,
will we have learned anything?
In the words of one of the oldest members of Dad's Army, we're doomed. just seemed very topical.
Or the other one, they don't like it up.
They don't like it up. Don't tell him your name, Pike. You know what I mean? That was a classic. 60. I think what I'd like to, my personal aspiration for another 60 is that we have offshoots. Maybe some, they're still very focused on the guests that we get in 60. I think we've had some really interesting guests in since Christmas, which has really kind of made us both up our game, I believe. I love it when you press the stop button. I go, do you know what? That really made me think. And that's, so it's kind of therapy plus. I quite like that. Maybe an opportunity to share those skills with people as well. You know, not just through events, but through, you know, people that are like-minded, that want to create their own podcast, but are looking to expand beyond being like-minded, because sometimes they can become echo chambers where people reinforce their own views, which doesn't really help. And also the opportunity to maybe theme some of them up around sort of, you know, what are going to be the big global issues over the next 10 years. So the Sustainable Development Goals, for example, around, you know, poverty, climate, gender equality, you know, work, you know, things like, you know, and not in a kind of scary iRobot sort of AI taking over and sort of Skynet becoming self-aware, which I'm from that generation that was terrified by Skynet becoming self-aware and creating the Terminator. But talking about, you know, the impact on technology and what kind of jobs is it going to affect and stuff like that. So, you know, you looked at things like Wired. I think they're really interesting magazines. You know, can we do our own one podcast around that? Can we assemble a group of people, like six people together, to have one of those kind of podcasts? Particularly, I think climate change, a bit of balance, people that are looking at the science as well as the pseudoscience and the citizens scientists and things like that. So for me, I think also looking at, you know, younger people and talking to bringing younger people in to talk about what they think about the world as well. Because like I said, that for me, that meeting last night about the NHS was really interesting, because one of the points that was made was by the lady that was doing it, Dr. Sally Rawton, was the fact that there's 80 providers, you know, providing this kind of care, and the ones that are at the better end of it, so they're not all bad, the ones that are at the better end were people that were formerly from the public sector. And I said, well, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because if you come here from the point of view of how can we support independent journalism, you know, because a qualified journalist who has set up an independent, the reason they've done that is because they want to get away from that control. So how do we go about supporting that, and also coming from the point of view that we're going to have to pay for it, you know, not that it's free, because if you want it free, then that's where Nigel Farage becomes an expert, and he's on everything, you know, because he does it. We need to really think about how we're funding our independent journalism to give people with the skills, the knowledge, the interest and the teeth to be able to go out there and start debunking some of these myths, fighting the fake news and finding the truth. And the thing is, of course, the truth is, you know, what's true to you can be true to me as well. So finding out what is the actual impact of something.
Finding out the shared experience, because we're just getting one side of it. I think for me, it's this, actually, kind of, we touched on this, it would be useful to replay it back, really, but the shifting, if you like, from a position of following to leading, and using the podcast as a way to, I'm not trying to set myself up or set us up as something, but there is a kind of sense that the people that we bring into the podcast, it isn't actually as random as it, you know, it might seem. And although you kind of follow in your nose and you're following your instinct with them, and you kind of bring in different people in, and just, you know, you're getting through one podcast and then the next one and then the next one.
Well, it's people you want to talk to, isn't it? And you're interested in finding out more about.
And there's a pattern that's building up out of that. And kind of just once you've been around the block a couple of times, you can start to be a bit more confident about it, and you can expand the variety. And it'll be interesting to go into some of the more less obvious nooks and crannies and talk to people who you might not think would be directly relevant to a conversation about sustainability or community development or community media or something like that.
But can I tell everybody listening something quite outrageous that you said when we were meeting a group of second year communication arts students in a community media cafe? They invited me and Rob and Pete Sutton from Takeover Radio to come and be experts. Three old white guys sitting on a sofa. It was like an analogy for the world, wasn't it? It was a t-shirt. And you said, if I'm really honest, and you looked at me, and I'm not sure I should say this, and you said, I actually don't want to talk to media students anymore. What I want to be talking to is youth workers, community workers, you know, people interested in community development, help, maybe health workers, social workers, about the value of community media and how you can use it in order to talk to your, you know, audience or the people that you're working with more than media, because media tends to be dominated by getting a series of skills in order to work in the industry, in inverted commas, whereas in fact a lot of what community media is about, and maybe that's one of the reasons why it struggles in that setting as well with students, is the fact that it's aimed at the wrong students that aren't naturally empathetic to the community they serve. They're more sort of focused on delivering content to an audience.
Yeah, there's too much confirmation.
See the look
bias
in the room when you said that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, the eyes, they all rolled their eyes.
Yeah.
What does he know?
Let's avoid that. That's the subject for another podcast.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
the day Rob calls everyone to roll their eyeballs.
Yeah. So, if somebody wants to get in contact with you,
at Doc Media Centre, yeah, get in touch. Come and see us.
As ever, this is a Decentred Media podcast, up at decentred.co.uk, on Twitter and iTunes at Decentred Media. But number 60 out the way. Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
You've been listening to the Decentred podcast. I'm Rob Watson. If you want to find out more information, contact me on Decentred Media via Twitter or go to decentred.co.uk.